From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, 12 Democrats hit the stage in Ohio last night for the latest 2020 presidential candidate debate.
At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people will save money on their health care bills.
Costs will go down for hardworking middle-class families.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this.
I got votes for that bill. I convinced people to vote for it.
I don't need lessons from you on courage.
Stars rose and fell, and a new frontrunner emerged. We'll debrief with our panel and take your calls. And politics can be a dirty game. Stick around, and later, we'll wash it all off with a forest bath.
This is forest therapy, which is inspired by forest bathing. And it's a practice of being in the body and leaning into the sensation of being alive.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Lonely in a crowd. We're kind of wondering if that's what Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren felt like last night. It was a crowded stage for the fourth Democratic debate in Ohio, but Warren took the heat from all sides over her progressive policies and plans. Here she is sparring with Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar. Technically, they were debating a wealth tax on the richest Americans, but the argument went a little deeper and maybe got a little personal.
My question is not why do Bernie and I support a wealth tax? It's why is it does everyone else on this stage think it is more important to protect billionaires than it is to invest in an entire generation of Americans?
Thank you, Senator Warren.
No one
Mayor
is supporting
Buttigieg.
Billionaires.
Mayor Buttigieg.
I want to give a reality check here to Elizabeth, because no one on this stage wants to protect billionaires. Not even the billionaire wants to protect billionaires. We just have different approaches. Your idea is not the only idea.
Look, I understand that this is hard, but I think as Democrats, we are going to succeed when we dream big and fight hard, not when we dream small and quit before we get started.
Oh, I would like to respond to that. So just because we have different ideas and get to the same place in terms of beating Donald Trump and taking this on, we are in Ohio. We can win Ohio in the presidency, but only if we unite around ideals and don't go fighting against each other.
All right. So here in Studio 3 to break it all down with us, Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman, now the public affairs director for Foley & Lardner. Welcome back.
Nice to see you again.
And Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's board of directors. Michael, thanks for being here.
Good to be here again.
We also want to hear from you. What did you make of last night's debate? Have you decided who you'll be voting for in 2020? What's the most important issue to you? And is it getting the attention you think it deserves? Call us, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can send us a tweet at Radio Boston. All right. So, gentlemen, what were your reactions to last night?
I thought it was probably the best debate we've had. I didn't like the format. 12 people is too many people. 3 hours is too long. I hope they rectify that in the next debate if there are 12 people that are coming.
I want to point out that Michael is vigorously nodding. As you're saying that, go ahead.
It was too much. But absent that, I thought it was a good debate, a lot of substance, showed a lot of differences between the candidates. I think pretty much everybody did a decent job. I don't think anybody really messed up last night. I think some did better than others as far as what they needed to do. But I don't think anybody, shot themselves in the foot.
Michael Curry, do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I thank God that you can record shows now, because I think I made it 3/4 of the way through, dozed off, then woke up at like 2 o'clock in the morning to finish watching the rest.
It was long and it was late.
but I thought overall, I thought the top tier candidates were sharp. I'm a bit of a policy wonk, so I enjoyed the conversation around gun laws, around Medicare for All. I thought there was substantive conversation. I think people tend to think that many people, you can't get too detailed. But I think, quite frankly, there was a lot of substance in what was debated last night if you were listening. So I thought that was helpful. I thought Senator Warren weathered the storm. I was very impressed with Corey, as I typically am throughout this process. Amy, I've not been a fan of hers, but she actually shocked me last night and had a little bit more feistiness and actually, you know, withheld, not actually attacked the front runners. And I thought she did a great job.
Like we heard at the top there.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk about Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg, who arguably represent a more moderate portion of the Democratic Party, made strong showings last night. And it did feel like the continuum was to some extent both on display and on debate between more progressive candidates, more moderate candidates. Where do you think the night came out on that continuum and sort of where the party is right now? Representative.
I don't know where he came out, but this is not a new argument within the Democratic Party. Pretty much every campaign we've ever had, especially for president, brings out that very issue. How progressive are we? How moderate are we? What issues are we talking about? I just think right now the struggle is for the individuals to say, I am the leader of this particular group. I think it's in theory between Bernie and Elizabeth as to which one is the more progressive. And I do think that both Klobuchar and Buttigieg helped themselves a lot last night to get into the ring with Joe Biden as contenders for the more moderate voices. Again, I don't think anybody else hurt themselves, but I think if I had to pick two, I don't like the word winners because nobody lost, but the people who helped themselves the most last night, it would be Buttigieg and Klobuchar.
And Michael Curry, let me just ask you, back to that montage that you heard at the top, any traction to Amy Klobuchar's argument that Elizabeth Warren is sort of saying, my way or the highway for the party?
No, I think some of this is just sort of a little bit of pomp and circumstance. You know, everyone's trying to find the quip. They're trying to go after the leader. The reality is that, as Senator Warren, she says she has a plan. When it comes to healthcare, I would challenge many of them on the stage to be able to even understand the complexities in healthcare like she does, like the congressman here does, and a few others in Congress. But there's some challenges, some legitimate challenges to how do you pay for it. And I thought that was the debate that I appreciated, whether it's Medicare for All or whether it's a Medicare for All light, like Amy and maybe some others might be open to. That was a substantive part of the debate. I think she made some traction. She will be out of this race shortly. I don't think she'll be there much longer. But it was an opportunity for her to really challenge the front runner, in this case, Senator Warren.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. If you want to join the conversation, if you were a Democrat and you watched last night, did you learn more than you knew before? If you were a Republican and you watched last night, did you see anyone that you think can hold up to Donald Trump in a general election? Call us and join the conversation. I do want to bring in an additional view now. Let's bring in Jennifer Braceras. She's a columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. She's on the line. Jennifer, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Well, how are you?
Good, thanks.
So how do you think the 12 candidates fared up there last night, Jennifer? And are there any moments that stuck out to you or candidates that you thought looked like they'd be strong against Donald Trump?
Well, clearly Warren is the one that everybody else thinks they need to beat. That's clear. She occupied the most airtime, and she was the subject of most of the attacks, which, you know, indicates to me that she's the person everybody else is afraid of. At the same time, though, I will tell you that the person Donald Trump is afraid of is Joe Biden, and that's why he's gone so hard after him, as we've seen, in the recent weeks. So the question is, which of these people can beat Donald Trump? And clearly Donald Trump thinks it's Joe Biden.
All right, let's dive into some issues now. And I do want to start with health care. It has been so prominent. Four debates. I actually saw a chart in the Washington Post today that showed it's gotten more time than any other issue. And that in a recent poll of Democratic voters, it was the most important issue to Democratic voters. Clearly, one of the things that came out last night was huge pressure from other candidates to try to get Elizabeth Warren to admit that she would have to raise taxes for the Medicare for All plan, and she refused to answer.
At the end of the day, the overwhelming majority of people will save money on their health care bills. But I do think it is appropriate to acknowledge that taxes will go up. They're going to go up significantly for the wealthy.
Well, Senator Warren, will you acknowledge what the senator just said about taxes going up?
So my view on this and what I have committed to is costs will go down for hardworking middle-class families.
At least Bernie's being honest here and saying how he's going to pay for this and that taxes are going to go up.
So, Congressman, rock in a hard place there. Clearly taxes would have to go up, but you say it, and now there's a sound clip for a potential.
This is not going to go away. It's going to get a lot worse, both in, no matter who's in the race, it's going to get worse. If you remember, after the first debate, this was the one issue I learned about in the first debate. I had never heard it presented that people were going to lose their private health insurance until that first debate. Since then, a lot of people are very concerned about this, and I think this is not going to go away. I think Klobuchar did an excellent job last night drawing a big, bold line under it. But even if she's gone, somebody else will pick it up. And even if Elizabeth Warren wins the primary, Donald Trump is not going to let it go. Now, again, I don't know if it's going to resonate with the average person. I think it's a really dangerous issue. As I said right from the beginning, I still believe it. And I think that when you don't address—
Dangerous being the idea of cutting private health insurance?
Dangerous in the sense that it's politically— I don't like the idea, but that's beside the point. I think it's dangerous politically for a nominee to be in favor of changing the health care for 150 million people, the vast majority of whom are happy with the health insurance that they have. All that being said, you can't escape answering a direct question, because if you don't answer it, the media will answer it for you. The people who you don't support you will answer it for you. Numbers will come out at some point. My guess is they probably already have Bernie Sanders numbers showing, and then we're going to do the argument of what the middle class is. Is it people earning $50,000 or $70,000? And I just think it's fine. I respect the position. Whether I agree with it or not, it's a different issue. I respect the position. You have an obligation to lay it out. And I actually think the Buttigieg's comment was, you have a plan for everything except for this.
Except for this $30 trillion
thing. I want to go back to another item that as well. I actually think the more important item was when the senator took on the rest of the people on the stage. I kind of think that was inappropriate and unnecessary. I think, again, Klobuchar's comeback was excellent. Nobody's here is protecting the billionaires and millionaires. We just have different proposals on the idea. I will tell you that I think it was part of the problems with Hillary Clinton and some other candidates we've had in the past, is people at some point come to the conclusion, this candidate is lecturing to me, this candidate is patronizing me, or whatever the term you want to use, and I don't like it. And I think if we get to that, I don't think we're there yet. If you get to that, and if you don't agree with me, you're no good. That's not a winning strategy.
Michael, you're nodding. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think the challenge for Senator Warren is she has to adjust. And just like the congressman said, she has to make sure she's not preaching or, in this case, teaching to people, but she's sharing her vision. I think that her arguments could have been more sharp. I think they're arguing for Medicare for all, and I do agree. Many Americans are going to say, I'm concerned that I'm not going to have an option. People want an option. But I think if she had laid it out that people spend over $10,000 plus a year on health care coverage, that they estimate about 50% of debt collections is medical debt. If you laid it out to what this means for the average American, and it will save you money in the long run, and you may, if you're middle income, you may have to pay more in taxes, but in the long run, it's a savings. She doesn't make a sharp argument like that. Bernie does.
He's very clear.
Because it's his plan.
Right.
So she really needs to adopt his plan and make a better argument if she's going to argue Medicare for all with no option.
All right. So let's pull Jennifer Braceras into this. Jennifer, so we've heard two perspectives here. I think my question to you, that 150 million people who do have private health insurance, and the subset of them that are not already Democratic voters, how important is this issue going to be overall in how they vote in the general election?
Look, if this election is a referendum on socialism, Donald Trump wins. It's that clear.
And you saying Medicare for all is essentially socialism?
It's one aspect of a socialist economy. It absolutely is. And I think the congressman is right when he says that Senator Warren is in danger of repeating some of the mistakes of Hillary Clinton. It's almost like the Democrats didn't learn their lesson from this. You cannot talk down to people. You cannot preach at them. You cannot wag your finger at them and expect them to, you know, be happy with that approach, especially when you're taking away their private health insurance. It is a very dangerous tactic, and I honestly believe that Donald Trump will beat her if she is the nominee and she continues on that path.
Just one point to that. I think what I'm concerned about is on the Republican side, Donald Trump swung for the fence and really forced people to think about what they wanted in the Republican Party without conceding. the left has to do the same thing. And I think there's a thing about this democratic process that I appreciate, which is people are being aspirational. What can we do around gun laws? What can we do about housing? What can we do about education? What can we do about health care? That has to play itself out. We should not just be trying to beat Donald Trump, but have a real conversation about the future of this country and what makes sense for people.
But when I have to just comment on what Michael said. Donald Trump won by appealing to independents. And I know that's hard to believe, but the truth is that the coalition that he put together of working class people in battleground states, along with people from the traditional Republican Party base, was groundbreaking.
And he played to their fears, which I think is really how he drew independents.
My point is that the Democrats are not going to attract independents or moderates by veering towards socialism. They have to find a way to come to the middle, as frankly Donald Trump did on certain issues.
All right, we have a caller who I think is relevant to this. Noelle from Norfolk, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I thought about last night after the debate, which I think is really important to think about, is every single person on that stage made a really important point, whether it was about education or housing or guns or whatever. Everybody contributed something really important. But when Cory Booker said, look, if we continue to go down this path of attacking one another or attacking one person who we all feel may be in the lead right now or however he said it, we will get nowhere. And that's really what was happening last night. Everybody knew Elizabeth's in the lead. She's most popular right now. And so everybody started attacking her and then attacking one another. And they need to get it together. If they don't come to terms with what's going on in the country, come together for one purpose, and then move forward, they'll get there.
Good. Thank you, Noelle. And if you want to join the conversation like Noelle, the number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Congressman, a primary is a fight among people inside a party. How does one find the balance between duking it out as necessary and not creating a circular firing squad?
That's a fair question, and it's a question that every candidate faces every primary, no matter what you're running for. And I actually think Noelle makes a good point. At the same time, it is a primary, and their differences are important. Again, for me, the thing that stuck me was when the senator took on the other 10 candidates on the campaign and suggested that they were somehow akin to Donald Trump's protecting a millionaire. That's not a good way to do it. I think it's perfectly fine for us to say, this is what I support, and I'd like to hear your opinion on it, and we will disagree and we'll argue about the issue. That's fine. But implying that the 10 of the candidates on the stage last night were protecting billionaires, first of all, I don't think many people believe it. And you know, people will disagree on how they're doing it. It comes back to bite you in the end. Donald Trump can use all these lines at a later time, which is one of the reasons why everybody has to answer questions about the details of their plans. Because if we don't do it now and get our opinions out there, test them, see what the American people really want, let people vote in a thoughtful manner, you think Donald Trump's going to let this go? I mean, any candidate. Of course they're going to pick up on it and beat us up on it later. So we need to do it now in a thoughtful and respectful manner.
Michael, go ahead.
And I think this Trump presidency has us all sort of twisted, and we want to beat him so much. But I think the process needs to play out the way it is. No one was on stage talking about each other's mother. Right. It wasn't. They barely wanted to talk about
the
son.
Thank you for pointing that out.
Biden's son. They barely wanted to bring him up. So I think there's a respect, but there is an ideological difference even within our party about issues. And we need to have that kind of debate in a primary. That's what this process is for. People need to accept that and embrace that. And then when it's time, the party needs to come together behind one candidate and beat Donald Trump.
Get in line.
But we're doing this the way it's supposed to work.
And they will come together unless there is personal animosity built up between now and then. And that's what I'm concerned about.
All right, I want to take one more call before we go to a break. Darren from Woburn is on the line. Go ahead, Darren.
Hi, thanks for having me on, guys. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. I just wanted to raise two issues. One is what's been brought up by Congressman Capuano and a few of the other commentators, which is that people are afraid of losing their health insurance. As a veterinarian married to a physician, I think we have to be honest that people don't like their health insurance. It's a labyrinthine process that we go through. My wife and I don't fully understand it.
So, Darren, jump into the second point, too, because I got to go to a break in a minute, and I want to get them both in.
Thank you. And the second point here is the idea that Senator Warren was actually lecturing to the other candidates. The big issue here is who is leading the Democratic Party. So I would offer to you that what you're actually seeing is a bold, assertive voice, trying to win over the Democratic Party. That's the other struggle that's underway here.
Great. Thank you for that, Darren. So I'm going to take us to a break. I want everybody to stick around, callers on the line and all three of our panelists. When we come back, let's do some compare and contrast of the bold versus the pragmatic in a number of policy issues. I'm Tisiana Deering. There's more coming up. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tisiana Deering, and we are breaking down the fourth Democratic debate, which aired last night. Still in Studio 3 with me, Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman and now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Thanks for staying with us. Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's board of directors. Michael, thanks.
You're welcome.
And on the line is Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. You still there, Jennifer?
I'm here.
Excellent. And how about you? Are you still there? Did you watch last night? What did you think? What's the most important issue to you? Is it getting the attention it deserves? And whose star is rising and whose star is falling? Call us and share your view. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Now, before the break, we had a caller who sort of framed up an opportunity to look at the bold and visionary versus pragmatic. Let's use foreign policy to do that, because I thought it was one of the more substantive foreign policy discussions we'd seen in the four debates, probably because of the recent decision by President Trump to withdraw U.S. troops from Syria and make room for Turkey to essentially go after the Kurds. There seemed to be pretty much universal condemnation for Trump's decision, but did anyone, and I guess I'll go to you first, Congressman, did anyone have a solution for what to do instead? Were there any practical answers?
I don't recall that there was anything that stood out. I mean, it's a very difficult and intractable problem, like most foreign policy issues, especially when gunfire starts. I think this is a difficult issue, and again, another of the many issues already difficult, and what Trump did made it even worse. I don't know that how to make it better. I didn't hear any real ideas from anybody last night how to make it better. But I think universal agreement that by pulling U.S. troops out and basically telling the Turks to go ahead and do what they wanted to do was clearly making it worse, not making it better. Making it better is a tougher issue, and it's a fair question. I don't know anybody's going to really come up with an answer that's going to thrill us all.
So, Michael Curry, let's listen to a little bit from Mayor Pete Buttigieg here. He spoke about how Trump's foreign policy decision in Syria sort of affected him, how he felt about it, and whether it dishonored American forces.
When I was deployed, not just the Afghan National Army forces, but the janitors put their lives on the line just by working with U.S. forces. I would have a hard time today looking an Afghan civilian or soldier in the eye after what just happened over there. And it is undermining the honor of our soldiers. You take away the honor of our soldiers, you might as well go after their body armor next.
So I'm wondering, Michael, is this a moment where military service has actually started to matter among the Democratic candidates? We only have two, I believe, who have such service. Has it become relevant?
Yeah, I think it's always been relevant. I think any Democratic candidate I've ever heard has an appreciation for the sacrifice and service of our veterans and our active duty military folks. I think what this came down to was, you know, there's something I hear on the Democratic side you don't hear on the Republican side, which is, and there's not enough opposition to this president, which is this is about life and death for people in those countries. And in particular, the abandoning of these people will mean that people will die. And it's that simple. I think the thing that I thought was most shocking was the exchange with Tulsi Gabbard and sort of her opposition to regime change. There is clearly some candidates who don't have a good, strong sense of foreign policy, who really don't belong in this conversation. And as I was listening to her and sort of exchange, I thought of the Sesame Street, one of these things just don't belong. She doesn't belong in this conversation at this point.
Here's that exchange.
You would continue this policy of the U.S. actually providing arms and support to terrorist groups in Syria like Al-Qaeda, HTS, al-Nusra and others, because they are the ones who have been the ground force in this regime change war. That's really what you're saying.
Mayor
Buttigieg. You can embrace, or you can put an end to endless war without embracing Donald
Will
Trump's
policy. Will you end
the
regime change war is the question.
What we are doing.
What is an endless war if it's not yet another regime change war?
Please allow him to respond.
Okay, what now we also have a caller on this. Jamie from Framingham is on the line. Jamie, go ahead.
I'd like to make two points. The first point is about Tulsi Gabbard's popularity or rising in the polls. And I'm a registered independent, and she totally appeals to me and her approach on, you know, my raid of the important topic. But, you know, she again was the most Googled candidate last night. And also, if you look at her Facebook pages and some of the commentary online, she repeatedly is a person who Republicans...
Oops, I lost you, Jamie, but this is the perfect chance to turn to Jennifer Braceras. Where does Tulsi Gabbard fit in this landscape, Jennifer?
Well, it's interesting. I'm not sure what the caller was getting at there because we lost her. But on foreign policy, she clearly represents the traditional left wing of the Democratic Party.
And what do you mean by that?
Well, she's more isolationist. She's not interventionist. She doesn't believe in wars to promote democracy or regime change, as she clearly articulated. Traditionally, you know, the parties were very clear on these issues. Democrats were more of that mindset, and Republicans, particularly neoconservatives, tended to be more hawkish. And that was a very clear dividing line. What we saw in 2016 was really a realignment, where that is not necessarily a partisan issue anymore. You have Republicans and independents who voted for Trump who want to pull the U.S. troops out of situations, and you have Democrats like Mayor Buttigieg who are more interventionist in terms of foreign policy. And in fact, I would argue Hillary Clinton was more interventionist in terms of foreign policy than Donald Trump campaigned on. So the parties have really... I won't say completely realigned, but there is a shift. There's a real shift, and it doesn't, you know, saying that somebody is a Democrat or a Republican doesn't necessarily tell you where they stand on foreign policy anymore the way it used to.
All right, let's take another call. Sanjay from Acton, go ahead.
Thank you. And this is in line with the point I'm trying to make is all the media attention is focused on top four or five candidates on the stage. The viewpoint Tulsi was bringing from foreign policy perspective and her broader idea, we are not giving enough coverage to candidates on the stage in our talks on the radio and TV.
Thank you for that, Sanjay. And there is this issue of... Okay, these debates are long, right? Last night was 3 hours. And yet at one level, we are still having a fairly surface conversation about what happened and what the issues are. How do we get deeper? And was there any candidate on the stage last night, Michael Curry, I'll go to you, who was prepared with the kind of depth that is necessary to govern?
It's funny because if you talk depth, I think, of course, Bernie Sanders is going to come as one of the folks who's always prepared. He's committed to his viewpoints and he'll make his arguments. And if you look at all the argumentation skills you would need, the appealing to people's sense of logic and having all the critical points to win a debate, he does that. I think the steam has gone from his campaign. So I think people hear him and appreciate him. I thought Senator Warren, other than that one failure around really justifying her Medicare for All and the implications for the middle class, I thought she did an excellent job. Others sort of filled in. So I think, you know, Biden was sort of absentee, and I don't know what that was, but he disappeared from this debate. So I think, you know, the people we expect to come with substance do. Buttigieg had an excellent debate. I thought he came with substance as well. And others, Kamala Harris and others, had limited time. If you look at the distribution in time, the folks that I mentioned tended to dominate the conversation, even in terms of the time that they had.
Now, we're going to have to, just because we have to, get to impeachment. But I cannot resist doing a little more policy before we do that. So let's shift to guns for a minute. And I want to start with some sound. Former Congressman Beto O'Rourke made waves at the last debate with his, "Hell yes, we're going to take your guns." At this one, he had to defend his plan for a mandatory gun buyback program, which led to an exchange between O'Rourke and Mayor Pete Buttigieg.
Listening to my fellow Americans, to those moms who demand action, to those students who march for our lives, who in fact came up with this extraordinary, bold peace plan that calls for mandatory buybacks, let's follow their inspiration and lead and not be limited by the polls and the consultants and the focus groups. Let's
Mayor
do what's
Buttigieg,
right while we have time to do what's right.
Mayor Buttigieg?
The problem is in the polls. The problem is the policy. And I don't need lessons from you on courage, political or personal.
Underlying that was whether or not there is room for the Democratic Party to go as strong as it seems inclined to go on guns. So, Congressman, where do we need to hear the Democratic Party go in a way that's going to play in the general election on guns?
Well, that's what elections are all about. I think thus far, from what I heard, the only one who's in favor of a mandatory buyback might be two now. I'm not sure where Kamala Harris went. Most of them were not. And I don't know if that's a personal opinion or if that's a political opinion. Either way, I don't know. I think from your listening audience, my guess is a mandatory buyback would be perfectly fine. Not so good in Ohio and Pennsylvania. This is one of the bigger issues of the heart and soul of the Democratic Party. What is it that you want to do? Do you want to be right or do you want to win? And can you do both? And that's a fair question during every primary. I want to go backwards a little bit as far as the other issues last night. I mean, Michael said that Joe Biden disappeared. I respectfully disagree. He had the second largest amount of time of talking last night. He doesn't talk in 30-second talking points, which may be a weakness on a debate stage like that. That's one of the reasons you get things like billionaires and millionaires. It's a shorthanded way to try to present an approach. I would agree totally. I think I actually would love to see the next debate. If we're going to have 12 candidates, cut them in half, six candidates for an hour and a half each, and then you can maybe have a better chance of drilling down a little bit for each one of them. With 12 candidates, I don't care how much time you give them. If you give them more time than 3 hours, everybody will be asleep. And if you give them less time, they will have even less time to talk about it. The format last night was not conducive to getting substantive issues debated on any of these things. And since I know most of the people on that stage, I will tell you every one of them that I know is fully prepared to have deep and detailed
yes,
discussions
yeah,
on every issue. They may not be able to do it in 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
They may not have the shorthanded way.
Right.
And that is that is one of the skills in a debate. I totally agree. Mm-hmm. And I actually think it's one of the shortcomings of a debate is to have that 30-second soundbite. You can't do that in healthcare. You can't do that in foreign policy. There's virtually nothing you can do it on.
Okay, so I'm going to turn to Jennifer Braceras. I asked a couple minutes ago, Jennifer, I asked the congressman, where do we need the Democrats to go to have a gun debate that will play in the general election? Where do we need to go with the impeachment conversation in a way that puts one foot in front of the other? And did you hear any of that last night?
Well, I don't happen to be a person who thinks that impeachment talk helps the Democrats and their electoral prospects.
Say some more about that.
Well, I think, again, this isn't as relevant in the primary, but the general election is about winning. And in order to win, you need to win over some Republicans or independents. And the polls show that Republicans are very dug in on defending Donald Trump. Polls show that people do not want to vote for their congressman if that person votes for impeachment in purple and red districts.
So let me just clarify quickly. When I say we in both of these cases, Jennifer, I mean the country in order to get one foot in front of the other. I just want to make sure I was being clear in my question to you as you're answering it.
Yeah, I guess maybe I'm not really sure what you're asking. I mean, because this debate is all about determining who is going to be the standard bearer of the Democratic Party. And ultimately, any party wants to nominate somebody who can beat the opposing party. That's what it's all about. And we can talk for hours and hours about who's more substantive or who has a bolder vision. But the reality is the only relevant question at the end of the day is who can beat Donald Trump. And look, I'm not a Democrat, but were I a Democrat, that's what I would be focusing on.
So go ahead, Congressman, and then I'll give Michael Corey the last word on this.
On impeachment, within Democratic Party, it's one thing, Jennifer's right, it's about the broader audience. At some point, Democrats are going to have these hearings in a public setting. Right now, the average American only knows what the media reports, and they can only absorb so much in a given time. If and when the Democrats get serious about impeachment, and I don't know, some of them are, some of them are not, if that's what's going to happen, they have to have these hearings, because then it's not about impeachment. Now the American people can make up their own mind on substantive issues that they've heard evidence on. They can become their own jury. And right now, all they have is secretive hearings, which I understand the need for at this stage. that stage will not last for this entire election season.
Okay, so Michael Curry, we are almost out of time. Where does it go? So what does the next debate need to offer viewers?
Well, to the congressman's point, less candidates. And I think there are several that have not qualified to your earlier caller. Tulsi Gabbard has not qualified yet.
That is true.
She has the number of donors, but not the polling necessary. Beto has not qualified. So we're hoping, and I think I'm hoping, that this will be whittled down to just some top-tier candidates. And then, to the congressman's point, there'll be more time for the substance. It is difficult to do the debate where you really can't get into the issues in a way that people can take it in and then make their decisions about the candidates. But I believe when we're in November with a few less candidates, maybe seven candidates, there'll be a better opportunity to do that.
All right. That is Michael Curry, former president of the Boston chapter of the NAACP and a member of the National NAACP's Board of Directors. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Representative Michael Capuano, former Massachusetts congressman and now the public affairs director for Foley and Lardner. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
And Jennifer Braceras, columnist and director of the Independent Women's Law Center. Jennifer, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So stay with us. Coming up after that, it is time for a nice forest bath. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick tried one out, and he's going to come tell us about it. Stay tuned. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. For our final segment today, we're going to talk about forest bathing. Forest bathing, or forest therapy, is a growing trend in the health and medical communities, both here and around the world.
This is forest therapy, which is inspired by forest bathing. And it's a practice of being in the body and leaning into the sensation of being alive. And we do that by spending time unplugging in nature.
That's Tam Willey, founder of Toadstool Walks and a certified forest therapy guide who leads walks in and around the Boston area. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick recently attended a forest therapy session with Tam, and he's here now to tell us about it. Hey there, Chris.
Hey, Tiziana.
So it sounds honestly kind of marvelous, especially right now. So tell us what it's like.
It was something I was really excited about. I read an article about a year ago, and I'm a big nature guy. I love camping. I love going for hikes. So I was really excited to try this out and see what it was all about. I was a little intrigued, I guess, or maybe even skeptical of why do I need a guide to walk through the woods, right? But as you mentioned, Tam was our guide. There was a group of about 12 of us. We met up outside one of the gates at the Arnold Arboretum in Jamaica Plain. And we started by walking to the first spot that we were going to basically circle up around. And on that walk, Tam encouraged us to share stories about times we either felt connected to nature or inspired by it. So really kind of drove home the point for me right away that this is both a very individualized experience, but also a communal one. So then we got to our spot and we sat in a circle, and Tam started by giving us a little bit of background info on the history of forest bathing.
Forest bathing is the literal translation in English of a Japanese term, shinden yoku, which was coined in 1982 in response to a national health crisis in Japan, where there was a spike in stress-related illness due to the tech boom. And due to this widening divide between humans and the natural environment that we evolved in. So what does that mean? It means more screen time, more time on computers, and which effectively dulls our senses. In response, there's this huge push towards getting people back outside in Japan and elsewhere and here right now. But just to acknowledge this, the shinden yoku lineage of forest bathing, in Japan there's certified forest therapy trails where people go to heal and restore themselves after working huge hours, being on computers all week long. And at these places, their blood pressure is taken, their heart's monitored, and there's been tons of studies where even their blood has been taken. And there's 30 plus years worth of research demonstrating what happens physiologically when we spend time in nature and unplug and relax. And I don't want to go too deeply into them because part of what we're doing here is like getting into our bodies and out of our heads.
I love the sound of the hooting
in
the background.
Yeah. And it was really interesting because then we kind of closed our eyes for 15 minutes or so. And Tam, it was almost like guided meditation in some ways, kind of giving prompts about being in the moment and taking in what our different senses were hearing or feeling. And so then we opened our eyes, came back to the group, and were invited to share if there was something that spoke to us or inspired us or that we felt a deep connection to. And we went around the circle doing that. And it was really great, I think, that the invitations were just that. It was very much, if you'd like to, if you're moved to, feel free to do this. But really, whatever it is that makes you happy, that's what you should do while you're here. And then it was time to start wandering.
So until the wandering, I really had been picturing this as a guided meditation.
It felt a lot like a yoga class in the woods in some ways, yeah.
All right, so then you introduced the wandering. What is that like? Is that like a hike or a nature walk?
So not quite either of those. It was much slower paced than a hike. It was really just kind of walking around slowly to take in the atmosphere. And it didn't have the kind of the science behind a nature walk. So we weren't trying to identify plant or tree species or things like that. It was really just if you see something that calls to you, walk over there and explore it and feel it and look at it and listen to the sounds. And it was very much an individualized experience. And then after about 15 or so minutes of that, Tam gave us a coyote call, which was the signal to circle back up. And we came back and talked about the things that jumped out to us.
And what did jump out to people? What were they responding to?
You know, it was really interesting. And I think that was one of the biggest takeaways I had was kind of the variety of perspectives people were bringing to the table. Some people noticed the way different creatures would interact with each other or the way the motion of the leaves against the stillness of the clouds. Or some people were using what they saw for metaphors for life. And other people were just kind of reacting to nature itself. It was really interesting, and I appreciated kind of all those different perspectives. We had a woman who lives in Brooklyn, New York, who was visiting in town. There was a young woman whose family came to the Boston area as a Jewish refugee from Uzbekistan. And there was another woman I spoke to, Nadine Mazzola, who mentioned during one of our sharing sessions that she got into forest therapy while she was going through treatment for breast cancer. Tam didn't tell us a lot of the studies. Like she said, she wanted us to be in the bodies. But one of the studies she did mention is a study about 10 years ago out of Japan that found that trees emit this substance. And you think the smell of pine trees. It's, mm-hmm. It's like that, basically. But it actually boosts NK cell activity in human bodies and natural killer cells. Those actually attack tumors or virus-infected cells. So it was kind of that push to find ways to boost her immune system while going through treatment that Nadine got into forest therapy.
When I first heard about forest bathing, it was because of the immunity boost and the NK cells that Tam talked about at the beginning of our walk that first gave me a red flag or got me interested in it, because healing from treatment for cancer, you're just interested in how can you boost your white blood cells, and that there is something that can actually do that is quite astounding, and that it comes from trees and just by being outside is even more wonderful. But it's really become a personal practice for me.
So I thought that was really interesting. Anyone who's been touched themselves or a loved one by cancer knows whatever it takes to possibly raise your immune system, you do it. But that the longer and the more she got involved in forest therapy, the more it became a bigger part of her life than she ever really expected.
I always say that when I was healing from my treatment for breast cancer is really when I needed the most help healing. And forest therapy has played such an instrumental role as a personal practice of just being able to be in relationship to the land, be outside with the trees and the forest, feel a sense of community there in whatever way that may be. It's hard to put into words, but it's just brought so much healing into my life. So much relaxation, just from the simple relaxation to a more deeper sense of connection and community.
She actually felt such a strong connection to this that she's gone on to become a forest therapy guide herself.
So this feels like a species level thing, Chris, yeah. or need. I have a brother who sort of lives for the outdoors, and used to be that he would periodically need to disappear into the woods for a few days with basically like a tarp and a knife and reset and would come back out
right.
truly reset. Did you get a sense of sort of the chi level of this?
No, I think there's something to that. I've always felt similarly. My wife and I go up to Acadia every year and just get out into the woods, and you come back, you feel like your batteries are recharged. There is something intrinsic about getting out into nature. So I asked him about that, and she said she thinks it goes so much deeper than we even realize.
Well, yeah, I mean, nature connection is an ancient practice. Our earliest ancestors, we're connected in a way where, you know, there was no real separation of like religion and spiritual practice and like daily survival. It was all intertwined. We had to be in a reciprocal relationship with the land to survive. Our senses were once strong enough that we could smell our food running over the hill miles away. And, you know, we all spoke bird language. It wasn't a hobby that like just... you know, deep nature connection people did. It was how we lived.
For me, it was crazy how much I felt like an 8-year-old kid. Just, oh, that looks really cool. I want to go check that out. And as I was kind of thinking about that and talking with Tam about this, it raised this question for me, because we're out there in the middle of the day on a Wednesday afternoon, and Tam is, she admits, running a business. She charges people to do this. And so it's not something that's accessible to everyone. So I asked Tam kind of how that reconciles in as she's conducting these walks.
I have my moments where I'm like, oh, I don't want to charge for this. I want everybody to have this. I want everybody to have everything. I think the way that I've heard it boiled down is like, privilege is power, and it's what you do with it. So I have this power to bring people outside and invite them to turn their phones off, and I believe so deeply and strongly in the ripple effects of that. Can anybody come do it? No, because people are at work. And no, not everyone can afford it, even though today was free, and a lot of these folks are my friends. But, you know, I feel like I want to take responsibility where I can. I want to step aside as a white person, as a person of privilege, when I can. And then I also want to, you know, use my privilege to help make change when I can. And I believe that this is a radical form of cultural repair.
So pretty big goal, but they're taking it one walk at a time.
Yeah, so there is a big goal there. Did this radical goal of cultural repair work for you?
You know, for me personally, I actually found it very effective. It was a really hard week that week. I had been looking forward to this, seeing it on my calendar. We had been covering some incredibly emotional stories that week. And so I needed that chance to kind of get out into the wilderness and unplug. And for me, the world just kind of makes more sense when you're out there and you can hear the birds singing and smell that fresh air and feel that breeze in your hair. And you're just surrounded by the trees and the natural element there. There's just nothing like it. And I wasn't the only one that felt that way. I could see that there were other folks that connected with it too. Shakti Marina Eskina, her family came here. I mentioned earlier, from Uzbekistan, Jewish refugee. She talked about the way she also feels this deep connection.
And I feel really connected to nature. I feel connected to the earth. And more I'm like remembering the depth of my connection. And at first I had no idea what I was getting myself into. with the forest therapy walk. And it blew my mind, actually, from the beginning. I think one of the first prompts that I vividly remember was, you know, imagining a picture frame around what you're looking at and seeing that as, like, seeing nature in that way. And then, like, the deeper the walk goes, I just feel like I'm both guided like into nature and into the depth of myself. And there's no rightness. Like there's no rightness, there's no wrongness. There's just being. Which I feel is a very sacred space and a sacred place to be. And to have somebody else hold the space is something that I need because I hold space for a lot of people. And to have a person connected to the earth, holding the space, the earth holding space for me, it just brings me deeper into myself.
Chris Siderick went on a forest bath. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, Jamie Bologna, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skoog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Tiziana Deering. I hope you'll join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.